Action can be defined many ways. Blend a bit of drama with history and you might have a war film. Skew more toward the imaginary and you could find yourself immersed in a sci-fi fantasy fest. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Druthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss two films that represent two very different definitions of film action. One is Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan's retelling of the campaign to rescue Britain's army during the early days of World War II. The second is Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, Luc Besson's adaptation of the popular French sci-fi graphic novel series. So don't touch that dial, because Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Hey, it's Fred Newman. You know what comes to my mind when I think of the word sustaining? You're moving, you're going a long way for a long time. You're the one with the map and the directions, and you're in control there because you are a Spokane Public Radio sustaining member. It's a word, sustaining, that leads directly to the future. Sustainers are members who choose to support the programs they value with a long-term commitment. Be a part of SPR's future and become a sustaining member today.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that certainly judges films, but does not typically judge film genres. We do our best to critique each film according to the expectations that its director sets for us. That process is especially important this week as we tackle two films that are as different as could be, even if they do have one essential stylistic touch in common. Both could be classified as action films. Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk is an at times pulse-pounding look at the desperate rescue effort made by Britain to save its trapped army from French beaches during the early summer of 1940. Luc Besson's Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets is a sci-fi fantasy adapted from a French-made graphic novel series. Let's begin with war. It's always a surprise, and mostly a pleasant one, when a filmmaker breaks out of the genre that has won him or her the most fame. Such is the case with Christopher Nolan and Dunkirk. His exploration of the storied incident for a week during the early summer of 1940, when some 900 British vessels, many of them civilian, rescued more than 338,000 British and French soldiers who had been cut off and surrounded by invading German forces. Until now, Nolan has been associated mostly with science fiction films such as Inception and Interstellar, and his superhero Dark Knight trilogy. So the reality-based Dunkirk is a true change of pace. What hasn't changed is Nolan's abilities behind the camera, which are apparent in sequences involving soldiers running for their lives, ships sinking in claustrophobic darkness, and in aerial dogfights that are likely to make viewers squirm in their seats. His screenwriting, though, is another story. Fully the final third of Dunkirk feels a bit repetitive, and some of Tom Hardy's flying scenes take a bit too much artistic license, especially when his Spitfire begins what seems like a magically long glide. Finally, other than Hardy and Mark Rylance, who plays one of the civilian boat owners just doing his duty, hardly any of the performances stand out. Nolan deserves credit for honoring the Dunkirk veterans, and his movies are always an education to watch. But despite a number of great sequences, Dunkirk itself misses being a great film. I'd call it merely greatish.
I don't know. I think it probably is a great film. And the more I think about it, the more I like Dunkirk. And I really want to see it again because this is an interesting movie. I mean, the way that you described it, I think you made it sound too much like an old war picture. And that's not what this is at all. In fact, I saw it less as a film about Dunkirk and about what happened there and who was involved. Because like you said, most of the characters here aren't really characters. They're players that he moves about on this chessboard that he has. I saw it more as like a study in disorientation, the disorientation of war, this idea that time is sort of immaterial when you're just waiting to be rescued and you have nowhere to go. And he structured this movie as kind of a triptych. You've got three different strands, land, sea, sky. One is set over the course of a week, another is set over the course of a day, another is set over the course of an hour, and they all converge at the very end and they weave in and out of one another, which I thought was really interesting. And I've been kind of a critic of Christopher Nolan in the sense that I think he relies too much on tricky narrative devices, on structure. And here I thought the structure really worked. At first I thought it was going to be kind of a gimmick, and then he ends up justifying it in the sense that, you know, I talked about that theme of disorientation. That comes through in the structure and not just in what we see the characters go through. There is some patriotism in this film, especially at the end when the civilians get involved. I mean, Mark Rylance is just a fisherman who decides that he has to do his duty and go and save these men that are stranded on this beach. And there is a shot near the end where you see all of the ships and the music swells, and it's a lump in the throat kind of moment. For the most part, Dunkirk, it's a remarkably bleak film. I mean, there's this numbing sense of defeat all the way through it, just the sense that no matter what these people do, nothing really matters in the end, right? Because they're basically just killing time until somebody comes and whisks them away. And there is something really depressing about that. But also, I don't feel like we've seen war films tackle that side of combat. What happens after everything has happened?
Well, and I think the intriguing part of Dunkirk, not only did you mention the sort of playing with time, which caught me off guard a little bit, mm-hmm. and I had to get in the groove and figure out what he was doing in that regard, but it also is one of those films that takes place very early in the war, and the focus is not on winning. It's not one of those films that may introduce us to the horror of combat, but in the end, like you're saying, there's this big moment and we know, you know, things are going to end well and so forth and so on. I mean, this is in 1940 and this whole situation drags on and on. I think it's intriguing to consider the possibility that these guys are going to be in this situation over and over again in various ways. And decisions are being made by people behind the scenes, which of course we can relate to that in more modern times, that don't always make sense. I mean, how did this happen that they were trapped in the situation to begin with? You know, I understand some of the strategy and tactics that were involved, but really when you think about it, Dunkirk is, we hope, an anomaly in terms of the situation. The geography was fairly clear. What was happening? I don't know. I mean, that's just my perhaps mistaken impression. I really liked the Tom Hardy flying sequences. Mm-hmm. I know Dan, mm-hmm. having come from a family, his dad was a naval aviator. I know he has some problems with the realism or authenticity aspects of it. But I liked the fact that if you're going to focus on that theme of disorientation, I think the Tom Hardy character and his cohorts who were flying on the British side had to deal with that to a greater extent than anyone else.
And let me be clear here. It's not that I didn't like the Tom Hardy sequences. I thought Tom Hardy was terrific, and I thought those sequences, I mean, I was the one squirming in my seat. It's like a video game. He's telling his flying mate to turn left so he can capture the guy, and you can't quite get the guy in his sights.
And that's the whole time, his gas gauge is broken.
Exactly.
And so he's trying to figure out, well, how much fuel do I have left?
That would be my nightmare, relying on math for my life.
And that's Nolan's tribute to Hitchcock, because that's exactly what Hitchcock would have done.
It's what Spielberg would do, too.
Set up two things against each other so that you're worried as the person. So something is happening right here, but there's this larger worry. So those things were really good. And I do appreciate the fact that he tried to do something different here with the week, day, and the hour. It just seemed to me, you called it interesting. I think it was interesting, too, in an experimental way. And it worked for the first third of the film, and maybe even the first half. But I thought that at the end, it just started to get really repetitive, and so many shots were going back and forth, and we're dealing with night and the day and what week, and I just got lost in the filmmaking itself rather than in the story. And trust me, I spent 31 months in the Army, and I know what it's like to be one of those guys who are sitting there going, what are we doing now? You know, and so that's what worked for me for the first half of the film. But in the end, as far as I was concerned, Nolan gave way to his notion, like Oliver Stone kind of does in some of his war films. He gives way to this larger notion of what a filmmaker is rather than being true to the story. So it didn't work for me.
But I think that the filmmaking is part of the story here, right? Because you talked about being sort of lost at the end. I think that was entirely intentional. He also kind of lets the dialogue get overpowered by Hans Zimmer's music score, which never lets up, we should say. I mean, once that music starts,
it's unrelenting.
It does create this sense of both urgency and, like you said, what are we doing here at the same time? Because it's amping up and amping up, but for what? So there is something of an irony in that, that it plays out like a thriller.
Particularly during the flying sequences.
Right, because the tone is that of a thriller, and yet what exactly is going to be the point of all
this? What about the acting, though, beyond Hardy and beyond, say, Mark Rylance? I mean, I thought Kenneth Branagh was...
It was a cameo, basically.
Judging this movie by the acting, I don't think is the right way to go about this, because it's not about the acting.
To me, the most challenging sequence involves a bunch of young soldiers who have gone to this boat and they're trapped, or so it seems, in this boat. And it sort of wavered on that edge of Lord of the Flies. And that's when we see most starkly the alliance between the British and the French and the lack of collaborative they are still the other to these English guys who were here. And so we see that more clearly. It's almost like they need someone to blame. They don't want to blame their own commanders for what happened. So it's like, oh, it must be the fault of the French that we're in this particular situation. And, you know, even though they are our allies, it's their fault. And so I thought that sequence sort of was a microcosm of all of the issues that were coming together with respect to what was happening.
Yeah, and that's another thing that bothered me, because there's a jillion stories to tell, and he decided to tell this story and making it shorthand for the larger message.
I think Dan's hating this movie more and more as we talk about it.
Well, I want to talk about something, because this is a big, loud movie, and one of the most powerful things in this movie are the silent moments that happen, the silent moments of defeat in Dunkirk. There's
like the whole beginning sequence.
Right at the beginning, when the bombs first fall, you see all of these young men, and we should stress they're very, very young, and they've seen things, you know, since before the movie even starts. They all hit the ground, the bombs fall, the sand goes everywhere, some people die, some people live, and what do the men that survive do? They just stand back up and just keep waiting as if nothing happened. And I thought that was a really powerful moment. I think it's one of the most powerful images of trauma in war that I've seen. We also need to call out a name we haven't mentioned, which is Hoyt van Hoytema. I think I pronounced that correctly. The cinematographer on this movie. Every shot in this film stunning to look
at. You know, and that's to credit Nolan's credit also. Yep. Let's also mention Michael Caine. Uncredited, he's the voice of the RAF.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Hey, Mike, what's up?
And that was our discussion of Dunkirk. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Dunkirk. Let's now move to the sci-fi study Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Maybe more than anyone, Luc Besson, for good and bad, has brought a sense of Hollywood to European cinema. In films such as La Femme Nikita, The Fifth Element, and most recently the Scarlett Johansson vehicle Lucy, Besson has adopted a style that would cause any Hollywood producer to blush Ferrari red. His adaptation of the graphic novel series Valerian and Laureline is titled Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. A film that he wrote, directed, and produced, Valerian is reminiscent mostly of The Fifth Element, Besson's 1997 sci-fi blockbuster that earned as many fans, especially as the years have passed, as it did critics during its first run. Valerian tells the story of the government operatives Valerian and his partner Laureline, who, in the process of retrieving a stolen item, stumble onto a larger mystery that, we gradually discover, is associated with a past genocide. And while much of the film boasts CGI sequences that are more imaginative, if not necessarily more original, than what The Fifth Element gave us, Valerian fails in two main ways. One, it seesaws between an ongoing series of crises, each one barely survived by our protagonists, which are sandwiched between one of the most forced romantic pairings since Charlton Heston kissed Kim Hunter in the original The Planet of the Apes film. Two, the casting of both Dane DeHaan as Valerian and fashion model-turned-actress Cara Delevingne as Laureline is as much curious as it is ineffective. DeHaan, as he showed in the recent A Cure for Wellness, can be effective in the right roles. As a decorated soldier? And Delevingne? Well, let's just say she's no Mila Jovovich, whose performance opposite Bruce Willis in The Fifth Element was as entertaining as it was career-making.
Yes, I think we must ask the question initially, who was responsible for casting this film? Because it missed so widely, I can't even begin to describe how that affected the rest of the film, because the two leads are just not up to the task in any way. And I've heard various explanations for what went wrong, or, you know, oh, they had to act against a green screen. That's the key word. Act, not just stand there and make goo-goo smirky eyes at each other or something. But let's talk about something that I think you're overlooking to some extent, Dan. I thought this film was visually very, very interesting and very, very beautiful at various points. Now, what's the problem? A lot of the scenes are derivative of name a sci-fi movie you can think of. Name a movie you can think of.
Star
for that
Wars.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Blade Runner.
That just popped into my head randomly.
Whoa, and it was a problem because one of the trailers for Blade Runner, the upcoming new version of Blade Runner, shows up before this film is screened. So that's a problem. Is it trying to be an homage to, like, Avatar? I don't know what's going on. All I can say is that it seems as though screening this particular visually entertaining film, even though it's a hot mess in many ways, should have played much better in states such as Washington and Colorado that have recreational marijuana available. Because it was beautiful, I thought. I mean,
yeah, I thought so too. I mean, Valerian, okay. I want to defend this movie a little bit because is it bad? Yes. Unquestionably, it's bad. But it is bad in a way that only a talented director could make a bad movie. And Luc Besson is a talented director. I mean, he's got this really unusual sense of action and of comedy. I mean, this movie goes from really dramatic moments to, like, Looney Tunes slapstick. You know, it's like a Tex Avery movie.
Like when Rihanna shows up, like, what'd you make of that?
The fact that Rihanna's appearance is, like, the least weird thing that happens in this movie,
like,
is telling you how weird it is.
And is one of the best performances by somebody who's not even an actress.
She's okay. I think that this movie, though, I do want to go to bat for its visuals, because this movie, it reminded me a lot of Jupiter Ascending in the sense that it's this movie that has all of these ideas and they're all up there on the screen, and yet they're in service of what? Nothing at all.
Another,
and that's
epic
the problem
failure.
Here.
Didn't it feel like a sophomoric film effort where you're like, oh, I get a chance to make a movie,
I can finally do everything I've ever wanted to do. And the problem is that Valerian, the comic book series, apparently inspired a bunch of stuff in the Star Wars series. So you're watching this movie that is reminiscent of a thing that was ripping off its original source material. So you've got this weird kind of circular familiarity, if that makes any sense. So there are all these creatures and all of these supporting characters that come in and you go, well, that's from Star Wars. Well, Star Wars got them from Valerian in the first place.
That's from Avatar.
Well, I think Star Wars is the big one here.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you've got the bustling space marketplaces and the scrap
the
merchants.
Cantina
and the back alley.
But this is
Ethan Hawke.
This is the big market.
Yeah.
And it's virtual.
And you've got the, you know, the red light district with Ethan Hawke in a cowboy hat and a nose ring as, like, this strip club hype man. It was so strange. So I think that you're right about Dane DeHaan. I don't know why they cast him in this. I mean, this role needs a Harrison Ford. You know, it needs somebody who's rakish, who's got that kind of Errol Flynn
vibe
about him.
And he looked like
he
was about 14. I mean, you could have plopped him down at any, like, middle school across the country, and he would have been more effective than he was as a leading man.
Yeah, no, Dane DeHaan, they keep trying to make him into a movie star, and he's more of like a Willem Dafoe than he is a Harrison Ford, you know. And I kind of liked Cara Delevingne in this. I thought she was all right. I thought she was way better than Dane DeHaan. And I thought Laureline was a way more interesting character than
Valerian. She was
a
more interesting character. here's the problem, I think. This young woman, I don't know if she has an acting career or not.
She was in Suicide Squad.
In terms of celebrity, I think she's sort of living her life large in the way that she wants to, and I really admire that about her. I think she would have been much better off starting her career with some parts like the Suicide Squad and working up to a leading role, but jumping her, I mean, she missed a few steps in this development, I think.
I thought she was fine. I didn't question her talent in any way because she kind of has this winking self-awareness about her that a movie like this so desperately needs and that Dane DeHaan does not have because he's trying so hard to be cool and so hard to be effortless, which you can't try to be effortless. You just are effortless.
That's right.
And you can see him trying in every frame of this movie, every beautiful, crazy frame of this movie. So I'm kind of two minds about it because it's way too long. It's what? It's 2 hours and 20 minutes or something like that. It's way too long. It's got energy to spare, but it doesn't really go anywhere. Dan, I have to applaud you because the plot synopsis that you read at the top of this review, I don't know how you were able to succinctly put this plot into three sentences and make it coherent because this movie is simultaneously so thin you can see through it and yet is so complicated and convoluted that I had no idea what was going on. There is actually a sequence in this movie where Valerian and Laureline have the bad general played by Clive Owen in front of them. Have you ever seen an actor slum as hard as Clive Owen does in this movie? And they stand there and they explain everything that's been going on in the movie, and I still didn't understand anything that happened in this movie. Something about a pearl, and then there are these little armadillo creatures that like spew pearls, and then there are these humanoid people from this beach planet, and there's all of this nonsense. I didn't understand what anything was.
You did have to suspend disbelief in everything else that
every
you
other
had
sense.
I want to go back
and underscore something I said because I had said Bassan had brought a Hollywood element to European cinema. But as you point out, Nathan, it's still European cinema in this farcical, strange, Jerry Lewis kind of way.
He's also brought European sensibilities to Hollywood cinema,
correct,
if you want to say that.
Yeah, for better or for worse, once again. But there's these characters who show up, other than Ethan Hawke, and it took me a while to recognize him. I was trying to whisper to Mary Pat, she's going, that's Ethan Hawke. And I went, oh God, it is Ethan Hawke. But who were the other two guys? There was the guy who was the guide into the big market. And then there was the guy who was the submarine commander.
Herbie Hancock is in this movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What's Herbie Hancock doing in this movie? Look, I need to get Herbie Hancock in my movie.
Right.
Like, what?
These are all my buddies. Maybe I can use his house off the coast of France.
I can stay there, yeah.
That's right. Well, at least there wasn't Chris Tucker.
From The Fifth Element.
And I also, Mary Pat was really down on Cara Delevingne as the movie was going, as when we were talking about it immediately after the movie was over. I didn't think she was that bad. But then I began thinking about what Mila Jovovich did in The Fifth Element.
Sure.
And, of course, she was given more to work with because she played this character who spoke in a screechy kind of style. And she was playing off Bruce Willis, who brings that effortlessness that you're talking about. So she wasn't having to work with Dane DeHaan going, what are you doing, pal?
This is what the problem is. This film cried out for, like, A-list stars to bring it to fruition, to make it pop, to make it flourish in some way. So then that's what I kept thinking. Well, he obviously had some casting choices, you know.
Yeah, if he's got Herbie Hancock.
People would want to work with him.
Yes.
You know, so why? Was that purposeful? Did he want, you know, so what did that add to the story? The fact that they didn't play out, were they supposed to be anti-heroes? Am I going to read the graphic novel to find out? Probably not. But those were the questions that were running through my mind. And my mind did wander a bit at various points, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Until the beauty brought you back.
No, I think I do think that it's rare to see a blockbuster that's as Looney Tunes as this one is. And I think that I wouldn't send my best friend to go see it, but it's bad in its own unique way. And so I kind of have some begrudging respect for it. And it looks pretty.
Yes. And that was Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Christopher Nolan's film Dunkirk. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenant for both producing and engineering the show, and let's recognize intern Jennifer Ravassia for her efforts. We thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again brave the world of contemporary cinema. Until then, remember the words of RAF fighter pilot Douglas Bader. The sea from Dunkirk to Dover during those days of the evacuation looked like any coastal road in England on a bank holiday. It was solid with shipping. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.